I'm Dan Dreher, and this is Colorado Matters. Today, we've come to the Denver studio of Colorado's famed abstract artist Vance Kirkland. What was once his private workspace and art school is now a museum brimming with art and objects of the 20th century. I mean, look around and you see furniture in the arts and crafts, Art Deco and Bauhaus styles. Rows of display cases line the walls with glassware and pottery and dinnerware of the last century. You'll find plenty of Vance Kirkland paintings as well. Sonic booms of color and texture structured in the larger collection like exclamation points. And you'll see the works of many other Colorado artists here as well. It feels like we've stepped into a tastefully overstuffed home, which just happens to have more priceless treasures than you could possibly digest in a single viewing. Hugh Grant, you're the curator of this museum. Did you intend to make it feel like a home?
Not exactly a home. We've never been a home. We've been the oldest commercial art building in Denver and the second oldest in Colorado after the Van Briggle Company. We wanted a homey feel to it, a kind of salon atmosphere is the way we describe it, where I've combined painting, sculpture, and decorative arts, and they're all intertwined together as they are in homes, or could make up as different collections of whatever age of the first three quarters of the 20th century.
You inherited the Vance Kirkland estate when he died in 1981. How did that come about?
It goes way back into a family history of mine where my mother and Vance Kirkland had a relationship during the 1930s, the great jazz age in America, and indeed they would go jazz dancing in some of the great, many great places, almost none of which exist these days, the great Albany Hotel and Ehlich's Dance Gardens and the Trocadero in Ehlich's and the Cosmo Hotel and places like that. But they didn't marry, and they married different spouses, but they stayed very, very close friends. And it was my mother, in fact, that encouraged him to go into abstract painting. And once he had made the decision to do it, but he received a lot of sort of contrary opinions to that kind of painting, which was fairly bizarre for this part of the country at that time. It was certainly well known in Europe at that time and in New York and the great art center there. But my mother sort of became his muse. His wife, Kirkland's own wife, was not knowledgeable or keen on abstract art. And so it was my mother and Kirkland that had this long-term bond. And so I grew up knowing him as a child. And then they were at our house for dinner probably once a month, some such thing. And then I went away to school at one point, to secondary school and college. But prior to that, I had been cutting the lawn here as a teenager and helping stretch canvas and gesso canvas, and was fascinated to see Kirkland making these paintings. It was just like it was like a dream. I mean, one would walk in and you would he'd be painting away, and you'd see the beginning of a painting, and then it'd be halfway through, and then Kirkland himself would say, "I have no idea what this painting is going to look like." Until I finish it. And so he said, "I'm very anxious to finish it." He would make jokes about that.
Is it true that you called him Uncle Vance?
Yes. And I was a little sandy. My hair was very blonde at the time.
What was the first thing you did when you conceived of having this museum here in Denver?
The first thing I had to do was really save it and hold it together. I had to hold the collections together when Kirkland died in 1981. And the reason that I got the estate, by the way, is that the Kirklands had no children, and his wife died first. They had been married for 29 years when she died. And then he lived about another 10 years after that, and then he died also. But the estate taxes were very difficult for me to pay off. It took 5.5 years to pay the estate taxes. And so I had a sound company at that time. I did a lot of the training programs for Johns Manville Corporation and Department of Energy and Department of Labor in Colorado. And it was a kind of horrible time. I worked 7 days a week for 5.5 years, and then I was worth zero because I had paid the estate taxes off. But I didn't want to sell the paintings for relatively little amounts of money that they were worth at that time. And the decorative arts collection was really quite extraordinary, but this was a small place, and the decorative arts at that time, before he died, was of course spread out into his studio and his home. So then all of a sudden it was all here in boxes as well.
Why not sell all his paintings and the other objects in his collection?
because then it would have decimated what is a very special collection, I thought, for not only Colorado, but for America. This is one of the most significant decorative arts collections, we're told, of any museum in actually North America, certainly in the United States. It's probably, several experts have said, the most important 20th century decorative collection on view, not in storage, as many other museums have great collections, but they're more in storage and ours is more out.
When you started, you didn't have the background as a curator, so how did you get up to speed on that?
Well, fortunately, Kirkland had an extraordinary library. He had thousands of books, and I have now read thousands of books, and it wasn't difficult. It was so fascinating because Kirkland loved music, and so did I. And so I would try and introduce subjects when he was alive of talking about art and ask him questions, and he'd be polite and he'd answer a few questions about the art and decorative art and painting and sculpture. But then he would almost immediately switch it to music because I knew a great deal about classical music, opera, orchestral music, and jazz too. He certainly loved jazz, as he shared with my mother as well.
Let's talk about Kirkland's life and work now a little more in detail. He started out working in watercolor, and he often painted Colorado scenes. We're standing in front of a pretty good example of that, Nevadaville. Would you describe it for us?
Yes. He did watercolor for 27 years, and he would do an extraordinary kind of watercolor where it's a kind of heroic technique. He would do very color-saturated pieces, so they're very, very strong color-wise. The particular piece, Nevadaville, that we're looking at was done in 1938. And Nevadaville is a little ghost town now above Central City. It's a few miles above Central City. It's very heavily rutted roads. You don't want to try and take if you go up through Central City, you go past the graveyards, and you arrive in Nevadaville. He painted it also in 1931. But this is a beautiful Colorado, pristine blue sky, and you can see touches of snow on the ground. And it's from one particular end of town, but you can very easily see to the other end of the town because it isn't a very big town, and most of it's gone, and even more of it's gone now because we're looking kind of a time in history. I mean, where this is, you can come in and relive, you know, what here's 1938 Nevadaville, and then you can go up and see it now. And so kind of a wonderful check for Colorado history.
What is it about this painting that suggests a Kirkland style?
I suppose the color that he has infused into the buildings, he's picking up reflections. He has buildings which are ochre, sort of a yellow ochre color, and they're red, and they're green, and they're blue, and that's contrasting to the blue sky and the white snow. And then even you're looking at beige dirt and foreground, but the beige dirt has incredible undertones of all kinds of different colors in it, mauves, purples, reds, things like that, oranges.
We're talking with Hugh Grant today, curator and director of the Vance Kirkland Museum in Denver. The newly expanded museum features Kirkland's paintings and other Colorado artists, as well as a vast collection of decorative arts of the 20th century. Kirkland in the 1930s and 40s was already well established. He was the founding director of the University of Denver School of Art, but he had a falling out. What happened?
Yes, he had made, presumably, he thought he had made an agreement with the administration that art students, of all people, would receive credit for their art courses towards degrees. And 4 years later, when his students came up for graduation, he was told otherwise, that they would have to take a number of other courses and that they were not going to accord the degrees of art. It was a sort of low blow. Very few schools, it's hard to understand that now, but very few schools in the United States had any kind of art courses and degree credit courses in art. They were sort of art people were considered second-class citizens. And so he had been teaching at Chappelle House, which was only a few blocks away from here, which was the, at that time, home of the Denver Art Museum. We had a connection to the Denver Art Museum years before. We had meetings of the Denver Art Museum here before Chappelle House was built, because the person who built our studio, Henry Reed, before Kirkland, was one of the 13 founders of the Denver Art Museum. So Kirkland knew this building existed, and he acquired it from Henry Reed, who was still alive, but he was ill. And he brought his students here. He made a deal with the University of Colorado that they could take their art courses here. They could take all their regular courses, their other courses at CU. thereby CU got a tremendous amount of students and tuition, and DU lost out. And that lasted until 1946, from 1932 to 1946.
He later returned when DU made him an offer that he couldn't refuse.
That is correct. By 1946, his school was even more successful. DU had no art school, or certainly not an accredited art school. So they offered him a salary larger than the chancellor's to get him back, and Kirkland then went back to DU.
Could you talk about this sense of Kirkland in the Denver social circles? I mean, he was considered an expert on many aspects of culture and art.
True, he was, because he had the great love of classical music and of jazz, and so he was very active with the Colorado Symphony supporter. He was on the board of the of a number of civic organizations. He was acting curator of the modern and contemporary department at the Denver Art Museum, on the accessions committee as well, active with the University of Denver Theater. He loved various different cultural things. He loved ballet.
There's a sense of humor, I think, right over your right shoulder here, Colorado Quartet. I wonder if you would describe that for our listeners who can't see it.
Yes. He could take leaves or rocks or any number of other things of Colorado, and he could do extraordinarily strange but wonderful things with them. Here he's taken some of his favorite leaf forms, and he's launched them into outer space, and they seem to be having a conversation together about the here and now and hereafter. But in other paintings, you'll see leaves doing dances on the prairie, or you'll see leaves, regular leaves, I mean, as you would see leaves, or you'll see leaves that don't even exist. He would make up plants that don't exist.
His sense of humor was even more direct in some cases. I'm thinking of the Seven Stages of Man. Tell us that story as an example of his sense of humor for his patrons.
Yes, he was asked to do a mural for a bar for the old Arthur Johnson home in 1936. And they asked him, they said, you know, maybe it'd be sort of fun to do the Seven Ages of Man. Maybe we were thinking about that. And he says in an interview in the Denver Art Museum catalog some time ago, he said, I thought that was so trite that I thought I had to come up with something else. And so I thought, well, fine, I'll do the Seven Drinks of Man through his ages. And, of course, he starts off with the baby has the bottle of milk, and you go through a teenager with pop, and you get to beer and champagne, and the last drink is formaldehyde. Great sense of humor.
Could you detect that sense of humor when you were calling him Uncle Vance and were watching him work?
Yes, he'd make jokes about various things and aspects of life, and he was even making jokes a few hours before he died, even, because, and he knew very well that he was about to die within a few hours, but he was making jokes. One of the stories was a nurse took hold of his hand and said, could I have your arm, please, Mr. Kirkland? We want to take your pulse. And he said, yes, he said, fine. He said, but I'll get you can have it if you give it back. I mean, he was, you know, when you're dying, about a few hours later, it was you know, it's very, very collected frame of mind. But then he had a collected frame of mind all his life, I think, to be able to do these paintings.
If you just tuned in, we're at the Vance Kirkland Museum today in downtown Denver, talking to Hugh Grant. He inherited Kirkland's estate and recently opened an expanded museum devoted to Kirkland's paintings, the work of other Colorado artists, and the decorative arts of the 20th century. So, Mr. Grant, we've moved into a different room, and here is sort of the main room as folks enter the museum. A long Frank Lloyd Wright table is at the center for people to sit down and enjoy the collection, and I mean the vast collection of things that are here. We're seeing all of the deco glasswork that you have here. We're seeing some surrealistic paintings of Kirkland's and some more of his more modern paintings. We were just talking about the watercolor paintings that Kirkland had done. Tell us how he moved into the surreal period and then the period after that.
He talked about wanting to change after he'd done a certain style for a certain length of time. He enjoyed just personally, as some artists do, and then others don't. Others will work in the same virtual style, although Warhol, for instance, could have slightly different periods, but he usually worked in the very contrasting, strong colors. Kirkland moved into a surrealist period where it was just prior to World War II, and then during World War II, he painted these paintings that really depicted his feelings about war and the violence of humans, and he reduced human beings to little cave people in these paintings, little tiny, almost stick figures, and then surrounded them with these extraordinary swirling shapes of deadwood and deadwood creatures and leaves and things like that.
Describe the painting that's just to my left shoulder here, looking at this richly green background surrealistic painting. What do we see there for listeners who can't see it?
Sure. It's, again, vague references to deadwood, and the deadwood is sprouting leaves, it appears, and the deadwood is almost taken flight and has wings. Deadwood, of course, is dead, but Kirkland, in a kind of wonderful, whimsical sense of humor that he elicited all his life, has deadwood coming to life and assuming shapes of creatures and wings, and the deadwood is morphing into living thing again.
It's clearly so original, and yet I wonder who was influencing him artistically at this time.
He talked about certainly Hieronymus Bosch, who had extraordinary forms, because obviously Kirkland, as a professor, knew about these things. Max Ernst was a great influence on Kirkland. For the later abstractions, Kandinsky probably was a great influence on Kirkland.
Which is a good segue to see the very next painting across the way in terms of abstract. Describe that for us.
There are actually two very large abstract paintings in the center room and then some other medium-sized ones. To go in order, Kirkland had come to know Jackson Pollock and de Kooning quite well when he was shown for 12 years at the Great Knoedler Company in New York. But he didn't want to do what they were doing, which is to thin their oils with mineral spirits and turpentine. And so it hit him that he could thin his oils with water and that nobody else was doing this. It also produces extraordinary surfaces unlike any other painter had ever done, which was exactly his aim. With his colors, they become very beautiful. They're infused with color. And the oil and water doesn't mix very well, but it creates this extraordinary cratered textured surface, almost moon-like as one would look through a telescope.
And that's interesting because at this time there was no NASA program, and he was really doing this as an imaginary vision and a voyage.
Correct. It not only predated the Hubble telescope, which we all think about now, but it predated Sputnik, which happened in 1957, and that was, of course, the Russian launch of Sputnik satellite. But he had begun the space paintings in 1954. He then went on to do the great dot paintings, where he would, over the oil and water patterns, he would put very precise dots of color that followed the very imprecise and somewhat accidental oil and water.
I would describe it as dizzying, almost, the way the dots are, on this one in particular, the red dots against a green and blue and purple background, are dizzying and demanding at the same time.
Yes, that's true. They seem to be very gripping for people. People describe them as mesmerizing, hypnotic. It's partially because they're producing vibrations. The colors are producing vibrations. Of course, sound waves are vibrations, since we're listening to radio. But as you look at these, your eye wanders around, and there are this tremendous give and take between the underlying oil and water patterns and the dots. One woman was standing here the other day, and I came through, and I said, and she was standing there. And then I came back, and she was still standing here as I went to go somewhere else. And I said, how are you doing? And she said, oh, fine. She said, I'm actually very fine. She said, I've never stood here and looked at an abstract painting this length of time. It's just extraordinary.
Does that please you as curator and also as a friend of Mr. Kirkland to have people come in and say that?
Yes, absolutely. To find that they're very excited about the whole surroundings, the atmosphere, the paintings. The Kirkland paintings are very strong. And there's so many different series that generally one can like one or two or three or many of the series. I think so many people walk out, possibly a third of the people, and they say, I've never liked modern and contemporary art, but I just find these amazing, and I don't even believe I'm saying this. They'll say, that I've never had such a strong, wonderful reaction to contemporary modern art.
You and Mr. Kirkland both are so steeped in music. Would you describe this painting musically?
A number of people see them musically. Kirkland had, he was synesthetic, which means that he could look at colors and sense tones, tonalities of and in music, he would listen to tonalities and he would see colors, and he could translate them back and forth between the two. A strange thing, he didn't talk about it very much because I think he felt that he'd be looked upon as even more strange than he was at the time that he was doing strange abstract art, which now looks just quintessentially modern. I mean, the art is sort of back and modern, and now we're, of course, we have contemporary art going on, but this is a wonderful resource of modern art.
And at the time, he lost followers because of this abstract art. What happened then?
He just stayed in the studio and worked. When he changed watercolor, at that point, he'd been in 18 group shows at the Art Institute of Chicago because he'd become a very famous watercolor painter. After he stopped watercolor, he was never shown at the Art Institute of Chicago again. It was a dramatic change. And yet it bothered him a little bit, I suppose. He wanted you do paintings and you'd like to share them with the public or friends or whatever, but he was so enthusiastic about what he was doing. And so he would work here, and he would be doing a dance around his paintings when he would do the oil and water. He had some straps that he threw himself across, because when you take a large abstract painting and you put it flat on a table, you're in deep trouble, because you cannot bend over a painting 8 to 10 hours a day, which is how he worked. And he's very ill at the time, furthermore, for his light dot paintings. For the last 11 years, he was dying of hepatitis, which means that he's exhausted. But he would start painting, and he would just forget that. Eventually, he would pass out, and he would lose consciousness at times. If he was in the straps, he was okay. But if he was painting on a smaller painting by the side of the table, he would lose consciousness and fall on the floor. So for the last few years of his life, he had me tie him to a chair to keep him from falling over onto the floor when he lost consciousness.
Did he ever talk about why he was so insistent on that approach to his art?
He loved the variegated surface. He loved to break up painting surfaces, and he knew that he was doing something that no other painter was doing as far as he knew. He was highly educated and had been to many museums, and many other people he knew through the curatorial and art museum world would come and say, this is very groundbreaking. This is a pioneering of a kind of modern art that doesn't exist anywhere in the world as far as we know. But then he was just driven to do it, and he just loved to do it. And he was driven to do very beautiful paintings. He liked to produce paintings that which aren't necessarily any better than very confrontational paintings that one, of course, can talk about as well. But he loved the idea of beautiful floating color and the idea of immense distances, time warp, fictitious galaxies and nebulas. Basically, he's inventing his own universe, just as he invented his own evolutionary system back in his surrealist paintings.
One reporter actually challenged him on these space paintings. Tell us that story.
Yes. It was at the 50-year retrospective in 1978. Kirkland died in 81, but he was still in marvelous condition at that time. And he was surrounded in several rooms by the later paintings, which is where this reporter stopped him. And he said, well, so Mr. Kirkland, he said, these titles are just unbelievable. He said, literally unbelievable. He said, this painting here is entitled Explosions on a Sun 70 Billion Light Years from Earth. And Kirkland said, yes, that's right. He said, wonderful, isn't it? And he said, yes, but what makes you think that that's what 70 billion light years from Earth looks like? And Kirkland, who was this little small guy, and he had a cane, and he looked up at him, and he said, well, tell me I'm wrong. Was a great response, and he, but again, he was making it up, and he wanted to do something that didn't look like anything that you see through a telescope. But and yet, they're extraordinary paintings, and you can believe they're nebulas and galaxies, but they aren't any kinds of nebulas and galaxies that have yet to be discovered. But who knows?
What effect did the NASA program have on him in the late '60s and early '70s in terms of his art?
In some ways, it had a very deleterious effect. It had a very negative effect because they, at one point, brought back photographs of nebulas that were certainly not the same, thank goodness, but similar to what he was doing in the oil and water paintings. And he abruptly stopped the entire series after 10 years. But then he went into the dot paintings, and so maybe that was a wonderful thing, on the other hand.
If you just tuned in, we're at the Vance Kirkland Museum in downtown Denver today. It contains the largest 20th century decorative arts collection on display in the country. We're talking with its curator and director, Hugh Grant, about Vance Kirkland, his life and his art. I'm fascinated by the sense of him strapping himself in to do his art, really, literally suffering for the sake of art. And folks who come to this museum can actually visit his studio where he worked.
Yes, there's four 3-inch straps strung from the ceiling, which he used, which used to be in green. They're black now, but he used army surplus kind of material straps that he would throw himself across. which indeed must have been very painful. I mean, it was. I tried it myself, and he had me in the straps a couple of times doing some minor things to his paintings. What also had skateboards underneath the painting where he could move the painting because he was in one position. And so he would attach skateboards to the stretchers on the painting. And then he had a hook on the end of a stick, and he could pull the painting back and forth and paint on it without having to get out of the straps.
I'm sure this changed a lot, but did he have a favorite place that he would start on a blank canvas?
I don't think so, really. He would start in various different areas and move outward. He would start with sometimes large cluster areas and then move out into other areas. And then you start in another area, and then he would fan those areas. He'd feather the areas together. He would make all the areas meet in different places and for a kind of a rough design, but he just made the design up as he went along.
And no sketches ahead of time?
No sketches ahead of time. He would say that I have no idea how this painting is going to end up, and I'm really anxious to find out, and so I'm working very fast because I really want to see what this painting is going to look like. So he just winged it, as they say.
And it took him a while to work on each of the paintings.
It did, and he had to work in relays, in fact, because he's working in oil paint, and the oil paint takes weeks and months to dry in some cases, depending on colors. Some colors dry longer than others, but he'd do the background on one painting, and then he'd have to let that dry, and he'd do a background on another, and then eventually he'd come back and he'd do the oil and water, and he'd do two or three layers of oil and water, and each layer of that had to dry. And then the dots and those layers had to dry. So the paintings were spread out all over the floor on the studio. We had paintings to almost wall-to-wall. Instead of wall-to-wall carpeting, we had wall-to-wall paintings.
So when people come in and they see the studio, they're seeing the straps, and what else are they are able to take in?
We have his original three tables where the paintings are down, and he could move the tables around in various combinations as he wanted. We have his original paints, his original dowels, brushes, and easels and a palette and palette knives and his tools.
How did it affect your work putting this museum together when you were so close to Mr. Kirkland?
Well, it was exhilarating, really. I think that's what kept me going through the dark days of trying to pay off the estate taxes and trying to keep the collection together without having to sell it off. I would come in, and I think particularly the later, the paintings, when you look at dot paintings and oil and water paintings, these extraordinary swirling, again, the sort of fictitious nebulas and galaxies, but they're very dramatic, they're very strong, and many of them are very beautiful, and it kept me going. I kept thinking, I have to save this whole thing.
Did he leave you any guidance in terms of what he wanted you to do to set this museum up?
No, he did point out on his deathbed, as we really did find out that he was dying, and he looked up at me at one point and said, you know, he said, you're going to have a hell of a time paying off the estate taxes. But that was about, I mean, he knew that it was going to be bad. But on the other hand, he said, maybe you should just sort of get whatever you can for the paintings and then go on with your life. So he didn't even want to shackle me with these things. But far from being shackled, it's just been exhilarating to do this.
At that time, on his deathbed, did you say, "No, I'm not gonna sell. I'm gonna make this a legacy"?
Yes, I did claim to want to do that, but then I think he had no idea that I could keep going like I did. I didn't either. You know, it's been a kind of tour de force to hang on and to keep going and to get donations and pull the thing together. Well worth it, I hope.
You began finding European museums that had an interest in his work. How did you do that?
Yes, I had an extraordinary man named Emeric Orosz who was Hungarian, but he'd become a film director in the United States, and he was traveling back and forth to Europe. And so he produced a documentary, television documentary for PBS in 1994. And he said, and after that, and we got extraordinary American museums involved and very famous curators of American museums. And then he said, I think we ought to try and get some European shows. And I said, well, you know, Americans aren't exactly loved over there. And he said, no, but he said, the art's going to make the difference. And indeed it did. And we got 13 European museum exhibitions in 10 countries between 1997 to 2000. It's even more extraordinary because five of the museums, several of them very great museums, had never given American shows. And they gave it to Vance Kirkland.
Do you think he's more respected outside the United States?
It's possible, but I don't know. It depends on where you're talking and what part of the United States and who's been here. We've had some curators and directors of museums come more recently, really. So it's possible, but it's hard to say.
Hugh Grant is our guest. He's the director and curator of the Vance Kirkland Museum in downtown Denver. At what point did you decide to make decorative art such a big part of this collection?
At the point that I finally had the collection together, I once again had some money and because I continued my own sound business for many years to accomplish that. And the decorative arts just seemed to be such an integral part of the entire museum. Or at that time, studio. So we were really Vance Kirkland studio at that time. But he always had decorative arts out, and he had surrounded himself with decorative arts. He loved to introduce people to modern forms of music, to modern forms of dinnerware, to modern forms of art. At one time, I remember we were about to do a party for some people, and he said, you know, these are very conservative people tonight that we're going to have. He said, I think we ought to unleash on them the most wild dinnerware we have. So it's a matter of seeing a lifestyle of a person. I mean, this is the life of a Colorado artist, and yet he was obviously very sophisticated. He had an incredible amount of dinnerware, glassware. Now, mind you, what he left me was dinnerware and glassware that was cracked and chipped and crazed, and so over the years I've had to replace it with things that could be shown that are in very good condition.
And how did you go about that, learning so many different areas? I mean, from dinnerware to glassware to furniture to pottery, from so many different periods of the 20th century.
I've had to buy masses of books on decorative arts, and dealers have helped me also. Once dealers found that I was not going to be in competition, I wasn't going to buy and sell, that I was putting a museum together, they sort of opened their hearts to me and their minds to me and taught me about decorative arts. And I've just read masses of books, thousands of books about the arts to educate myself on this. There's the aspect of being able to look at something and know that it relates to something else and that something is great art as opposed to a lot of dinnerware and glassware that isn't particularly great art. And maybe I got that from Kirkland, or maybe there's something innate in me as well. But that's helped a lot, I think.
Some of these items were in Kirkland's own collection, as you've told us, but you expanded it enormously. Mm-hmm. I guess, how did you go from the poorhouse when you were struggling to pay taxes to amassing this collection through the recent expansion of the original studio?
We've been very fortunate to have a great deal of support within Colorado. I think the fact that Kirkland has a great chance to become very famous out of Colorado, and that's made a great deal of difference to corporations and to foundations and private support and people who are beginning to visit us and get donations as well from them. And the excitement of what we are. I think people realized what, even out of the old studio, when I was about one-third the size, but I still had the wonderful decorative arts, and I had a lot of it out. But then, of course, we have much more out now. But it was a matter of it just kept like a little snowball rolling down the hill, I suppose.
What would Uncle Vance say if he walked in here today?
That's a good question. I've certainly pondered that at times. I don't know. He might think he'd probably just think, you know, I want to go back and just start painting at the table again. Except he was very social, and he would love to have people here as well. But he would be undoubtedly just amazed at the fact that I managed to keep it together, about as amazed as I am.
Hugh Grant is director and curator of the Vance Kirkland Museum in downtown Denver. Thank you very much for showing us around today.
Well, thank you. It's been a great pleasure to have you here.